at northerntickets.com and live at rickshaw.com.
From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Today, Mauricio Drelichman of the Vancouver School of Economics, an expert on something very much in today's news, borrowing and lending. And certainly stories of 25% interest for car loans have been very much in the public eye. And every day there is this concern about possible interest rate hikes. But today, perhaps we'll get a glimpse of the future as well as the past. Mauricio, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ida. It's great to be here.
Thank you. So one doesn't always think necessarily that lending and borrowing has a history. Unless, of course, you study Shakespeare and The Merchant of Venice. But is there really a well-defined history of borrowing and lending?
Much more than you would think. Borrowing and lending are very, very old economic transactions. In my particular case, what I study is sovereign borrowing, that is, borrowing by governments. And kings have been borrowing for as long as we have recorded history, sometimes just in the form of merchant credit. They will take some goods and pay for them later. Sometimes in the more formal bonds like we know them today. So it's hard to say when borrowing and lending begins. We know, for example, that the Romans did not have public debt. The Roman state never borrowed or lent. It lived on a cash basis. So they had these chests where they put the money, and they took the money out of them when they needed it. Medieval kings did borrow, and we know English kings borrowed a lot, and every now and then they defaulted on their debts, and that way, for example, they caused the bankruptcy of several Florentine bankers. In my work, what I look at is the beginning of modern sovereign debt, which we define as borrowing through financial instruments that specify how much is being lent and how much you have to repay and when, so they imply an interest rate. And it's clearly acknowledged that the borrower is a sovereign and that you cannot really take him to court because he is the source of justice. So the questions we ask are, well, why would anyone in their right mind lend to someone that has all that much power? And that's a question that's very relevant today because we keep lending to sovereigns, we keep lending to governments, and we could potentially not be paid back.
Well, I would think so. And I think the question of control is a fairly frightening one, because who would set the interest rate if, in fact, we are lending money to a government or to a sovereign?
Mm-hmm. So usually interest rates are, as economists say, set by supply and demand. Depending on how many lenders are willing to lend to the sovereign, the interest rate will be the result of an interaction between the amounts of funds available and the amount of funds the sovereign actually wishes to borrow. And then there will be an adjustment to that dictated by the risk that the borrower perceives that the sovereign will not pay back. The riskier the sovereign, the higher the rate. So these interest rates are usually the result of market transactions because you have several competing lenders and also several competing potential borrowers with different risk characteristics.
So is it fair to say, though, that certain countries have practices that differ from other countries, so that perhaps a country in Europe, their practice may differ from a country in Latin America or even in Asia?
Mm-hmm. So what these countries have are different reputations. For example, Canada has never defaulted on its debt, and because of that, it has what it's typically known as a prime credit rating, this famous triple A's that credit rating agencies give countries. Latin American countries, pretty much all of them, have defaulted on their debts. And so investors are wary of lending to them. And when they do, they demand higher premium, higher interest rates. So sometimes countries that do not enjoy a perfect credit history, what they will do is try to offer guarantees or collateral or some sort of assurance to the borrowers. For example, typically developing countries will issue bonds denominated in US dollars or euros or a currency other than their own. So they are protecting the lender from a devaluation in the currency that could diminish the value of their assets.
Oh, all right. So I'm a king and I need some money. What do I need the money for? Fight a war?
If you are in the 16th century like my king, sir, yes, 90% of your budget goes to fighting wars.
I see. So this is an investment in my country's future and perhaps my own survival.
It is. Sometimes it's a fight over a territory that's very rich, and you expect that if the king wins the war, he will tax this territory heavily and be able to pay back the loans from that money.
Of course.
Sometimes it's a defensive war. Your enemies are attacking you. For example, they may be attacking the source of your trade, which you need to collect taxes. And so you borrow to defend your trade and continue to service all debts. There are different reasons for fighting wars, but essentially between 1500 and maybe even 1800, war is known as the sport of kings. And particularly European countries fight wars all the time.
Have you been able to chart, perhaps even demographically, periods in which this borrowing is extremely intense and other periods where it doesn't seem to be very active at all?
We have, and it is extremely correlated with the incidence of warfare. So in our upcoming book with Hans-Joachim Voth, who's a professor at the University of Zurich, we looked at the yearly borrowing by King Philip II of Spain between the years of 1566 and 1596. There are three decades there. The first and the third decade had very high warfare intensity and correspondingly very high borrowing by the sovereign. The middle decade had very low warfare intensity, and the king essentially earned a peace dividend. He was able to reduce his debt, pay back these loans, because he didn't have anything to spend the money on, essentially.
Fascinating. Okay, so I want to ask you, in this popular history, The Ascent of Money, Niall Ferguson's book, he says, without the foundation of borrowing and lending, the economic history of the world would not have gotten off the ground. Do you agree with that broad generalization?
It's very hard to understand what Niall Ferguson talks about with these grand phrases. I agree that borrowing and lending allow both individuals and governments to utilize their economic resources more efficiently. So if I know that I will be paid for a job a year from now, well, it would be perfectly reasonable for me to take out a loan and start consuming today because I know the money is coming. And it would not be efficient for me to actually wait until I'm paid because I would be depriving myself of present consumption. So borrowing and lending is a crucial element to do that. In the case of sovereigns and states, they also have very big fluctuations in their income. Spain in the 16th century, for example, depended for about 25% of its revenue on shipments of silver from the Americas. And these shipments were subject to the inclemencies of the weather. And some years, the hurricane season did not allow the fleets to sail. Without borrowing, they could not have met their obligations. And it was perfectly reasonable to borrow because you knew that that silver was coming the following year. It was just being delayed in Cuba because the fleet could not sail. So clearly borrowing and lending serve a very useful and crucial purpose. I don't know what it means that the economic history of the world would not have taken off.
I'm sure a lot of readers don't either. Tell me a little bit about your interest in Spain. How did that emerge?
It's a bit serendipitous. So my entire research program for the past 10 years has focused on Spain. And it all stemmed for one research paper that I wrote for a course in the second year of my doctoral degree. In economic history, when done right, you have to get very intimate with your archival sources. You have to travel to the location, look at these original documents. It's the part of the job I enjoy the most, working with 500-year-old pieces of paper signed by kings and queens. Sometimes I'm the first person to touch them in 500 years. But doing that requires a lot of investment. You need to really learn how the archives work. You need to learn where the documents are. You need to spend a lot of time learning just to read the calligraphy. Once you have done that, you want to that investment to continue to yield fruits. So you typically keep working on the same topic as I have for 10 years.
Is it something about Spanish history, though, or personalities that has really kept you connected?
I was always attracted to the biographies of Spanish kings and Spanish literary figures. Part of that is just my education. I grew up in Argentina, and your past is intimately linked to Spain. And part of that, I guess, is just an innate attraction. I'm not sure I can explain it, but I love going to Spain and immersing myself in this past.
Archives easily accessible in Spain, particularly from, you know, the 15th century, 16th century?
So Spanish archives are open to the public. All you need to do is show up with your passport in hand, and you will be granted access, and you will be given any document you request, as long as it's available. Now, what's happening is more and more documents are being microfilmed or digitized, and the policy is that if a microfilm or digital copy exists, you will not be given access to the original document unless you have a very specific reason to request it. For example, you want to study something related to the texture of the paper or the colors or something like that. If you just want to read from it, you're going to have to make do with a digital copy. So that is a bit of a frustration for me because I really enjoy working with the original documents.
So tell me something about one of your surprises that you found in the archives that you didn't expect to identify or see. Mm-hmm.
So if you do archival work, I can guarantee that you will be surprised in many ways. And knowing that, every time I go to Spain now, I schedule unstructured time at the archive. So say if I'm there for 3 weeks, I will have a plan for every day except for the last two. And the last two, I will go crazy with the catalog and order things that just catch my eye. Sometimes it's descriptors that you think there may be something interesting there. Sometimes it's because the archival unit has not been fully described. So you order the catalog, and the catalog says boxes containing documents. And you go, thank you for the magic. It's like, I'm sure there are boxes containing documents there. What are the documents about? So one of my favorite ones, I was working on a paper on privileges of nobility. And there was this particularly privileges of petty nobility. There was this one document described as privilege given by King John II in 1312. I didn't say what it was. So I ordered it, and 15 minutes later, someone comes and says, are you sure you want to see that document? And my response was, well, now that you ask that way, of course. So another 15 minutes go back, and the document is brought into the room by four people, each of them holding one corner of the document. It's about a meter and a half by a meter and a half, a huge square of parchment. They place it on a table. And they tell me, you can look it in any way you want, you cannot touch it. So now you're picturing this enormous piece of paper and you just have to do some acrobatics over it to read it. Turns out it was the very first privilege of nobility that was kept at the archive, and it had never been documented as such. So I was involved in changing the archival classification of that document, and I was able to trace the story of these privileges about 100 years earlier than it had formerly been done.
That would be pretty electrifying, I would think, and to realize that, and to have the four carrying it out as well.
I can tell you that all the researchers at the archive were looking at me with great interest.
Absolutely. I know one of the projects you've been recently involved in has a very intriguing title, Housing and Cost of Living in 16th Century Toledo. How did you gather information to write such a piece?
So this is Toledo, Spain, not Toledo, Ohio. We have had to make the clarification. And my co-author, who's a graduate student at Universidad Complutense, knows very well the archive of the Cathedral of Toledo. And he discovered this inventory of about 600 houses that the cathedral owned starting in the 15th century. And what they did was they rented them out. Okay. So we started brainstorming a little about it. And now, just as we are concerned today with calculating the cost of living to figure out what inflation is and what poverty lines are, economic historians are concerned with calculating the cost of living in previous eras. Because, for example, we want to know how standards of living evolved and also how to convert monetary quantities from 300 years back to today. But we are usually hampered in that effort because we do not know anything or almost anything about the most important component of the cost of living, which is rent. Today, people spend about one third of their income on rent. In the past, it was less, but we figure it's still about 10 to 15%. And we know nothing about that because there are no records. And we found this fantastic data source at the Cathedral of Toledo that gave us a great description of every single house they own, down to the measurements, the use of the rooms, and where exactly in the city the house was located, and also a yearly series of the rent paid for each of those houses. So we were able to place these houses on a map using GPS coordinates, and we were able to describe all the characteristics of each of them and figure out what were people paying for. Were patios a feature that raised your rent? Was being closer to the cathedral a plus or a minus? Was having a space for your horses? How much did you pay for that? Having access to water, having a well, having quarters for your servants, and so on. So it was quite a ride.
This is remarkable material. Would you ever think of editing and publishing the material itself? Without a kind of analysis, just to have it available?
Once we publish the analysis, we are definitely looking forward to making the material available as well for other researchers because it's valuable to just have it out there, and B, it's having the data available is usually what drives citations to your work. So yes, that's very, very much on our radar screen. This paper is now being submitted, and we hope it will be published soon.
That's marvelous. So, but I do want to know, when you were growing up in Argentina, did you ever think of opening a bank?
No, not at all. I wanted to study philosophy when I was growing up.
Well, it's probably great preparation for, you know, exactly what you're doing now. Okay, let's try and think of the subject perhaps in a little more individual way. If I studied the history of borrowing, would I become a smarter borrower myself, do you think, as far as an individual is concerned, whether it's mortgages or a personal loan or anything of that sort?
Well, I guess once you understand what the basic mechanisms of borrowing and lending are, you would almost automatically become a better borrower or lender. One of my favorite stunts is to go to a bank to renegotiate my mortgage or ask for a credit card. And I start listening to the sales pitch of the customer service representative. And at some point into it, they ask, well, what do you do for a living? And I say, I'm an economics prof. I teach about borrowing and lending. And that usually puts a quick damper over the entire conversation. But there are really very few basic principles that you need to understand in order not to get into trouble, I guess.
Mm. What do you think is the future of lending, either on the sovereign level or in terms of individuals or groups of individuals?
Well, it's going to stay with us for a long time. Lending is pretty useful. I think the 2008 crisis has taught us quite a bit about the limits of innovation within lending. And what happened there is there were investment banks and individual traders coming up with very innovative contracts, so innovative that most people did not understand how they worked. But there was this